What is up, guys? Welcome back. Welcome back to the third episode of New Dogs, Old Tricks, which can't believe we're already at three, right?
I mean, yeah, it's just,
we'll talk about every time how this just started at the kitchen table. It's just fantastic. I love how we keep getting to talk to and just meet these fantastic firemen, firefighters, and just keep on growing this. So it is awesome. Welcome back. Episode three. We're so excited for our guest. And that's kind of all the announcements we have. I mean, what better one to have no announcements than to have Blatz have as much time as possible with all of his stories and all the knowledge that this guy has.
So, our very own.
Yeah, our very own. We are absolutely lucky to have him. We'll have him do a little introduction and talk about him here. But without further ado, right into it, we've got retired Milwaukee firefighter, Lieutenant Blatz.
Retired, you make me sound really old.
Nah, there we go. You don't want me up there. We want Blatz up there. Right. How's it going, Blatz?
Good. How you guys doing?
We're fantastic.
Right on.
So like we said, without further ado, we got you right into here. So I wanted to leave as much time for you to kind of talk about everything here. And we'll give you a little bit of time to introduce yourself, talk a little about yourself and your career, and everybody know who you are.
Awesome. So obviously you guys already spilled the beans. I'm paid on call with Beaver Dam right now. But I did 28 and a half years with City of Milwaukee. Retired out of Rescue 2, spent 7 years there, probably the greatest company I ever worked with, but, you know, it took a lot of work to get there, but 20 and a half years with the City of Milwaukee, and obviously I couldn't give it up, but I just needed a break. I needed to get out of the city, so moved out here to Beaver Dam, and, you know, still trying to stay with it, you know, stay involved with the community as well as the fire department. So, just had a great career.
Yeah, we're absolutely honored to have you on here. It's fantastic. Brian and I talk about all the time and everybody that it's just awesome that we get to have someone like you that comes and is moonlighting with us and basically has your retirement gig, not to, like you said, make you sound old, but when you come with that much experience from Milwaukee and then come to our little department, it's such a good kind of attitude change and just you have so much knowledge for there. So it's awesome to have you and we're honored to have you on here because we're going to get deep into some of that stuff. So
awesome.
Well, perfect. I mean, as this is absolutely the quickest one that we've gotten in here, which like I will keep saying is fantastic. We'll let you talk all day. So without further ado, we got our questions for you. You got a little bit of heads up on them, but we've got some new questions to ask you. Like we said, coming from new firefighters, this is stuff we've been either wanted to ask you or people that we've talked to have been wanting to ask you or any of these experienced members of the service. So we got our first one. How did you end up in the fire service? Pretty simple.
So that's kind of a funny question because I kind of ended up in the fire service by accident, to be honest with you. My brother, you might have heard the story before. My brother was the one who wanted to be the firefighter. And my brother was a year older than me, so obviously we hung out quite a bit, you know, through grade school, through high school. He said, hey, let's go take this exam for City Milwaukee Fire Department. So we both went and filled out the applications. And the first time I took the exam, actually both times I took the exam, my brother literally had to come get me out of the bar at bar time. I shit you not, the night before the exam, Friday, you know, they had the exams on Saturday mornings.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm in a bar with my buddies having a good time. And he would come in there and literally drag me out and say, hey, we got to take this exam in the morning. And, you know, the first time we both took it, we ended up, you know, far back. I think at the time there was probably 6,000 applicants for maybe 100 positions. It's not like it is today.
Not at all. Yeah.
Everybody, you pick up a job on one department. You don't like it. You just laterally transfer, or you know, you go apply at the next house the next day. You know.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that. The first time I took the exam, I didn't get in, and then he coaxed me into doing it again, and you know, same thing, two in the morning. He's bringing me out of the bar. It's kind of funny. I hate to say this, but I remember in line with these 6,000 people. It's like 90 degrees out, hot as hell. I'm throwing up because I'm so hungover. I'm not shitting. They got us in this high school, Madison High School in Milwaukee was the testing place. I'm sitting in, you know, the auditorium, and you're like every other seat, so you don't cheat, right? And I remember it was just terrible. It was hot, no air movement. I took the exam, and believe it or not, I ended up 109 on that list. And at the time, Milwaukee was running through three classes. It was normally three recruit classes of right around 35, 36 a year. All right. So I was kind of on the bubble. Like, yeah. Am I going to get in even at 109? Am I going to get a job or am I not?
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, some people, even after taking the exam, they don't pass the background check or, you know, change your mind as far as want to be a firefighter. I got the call. I got a letter in the mail. And sure shit, started the academy in July of 1990, which, you know, to me doesn't seem like that long ago because I'm going to tell you young guys right now, you know, you've heard the saying, don't blink. And it's God's honest truth. Your career will go that fast. You know, next thing you know it, I start the academy in July of 90. At the time, it was a 23-week academy. You didn't have to be an EMT even. So they did EMT class as part of the academy. So Monday, Tuesday was fire. Wednesday was EMT class all day. And then Thursday, Friday was back to fire. And we did that for 23 weeks. And then obviously got out of the academy and were assigned to company. So, you know, the academy are those days where you kind of think, you know, what the hell am I doing here? But we had a great group of guys in the academy. And obviously you bring everybody up, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We bonded as a group. I think we started out with 36, and I think we ended up with 32. You know, that was back in the day when they could actually bounce you out if you didn't complete the objective. You know, I mean, not saying they don't do that now, but I think
it's a lot harder to get bounced out nowadays. Yeah. It really is.
You know, I mean, so you really had a total life or you knew you were out of a job and, you know, not only out of a job, but obviously you gave up your previous job to be on this one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was all or nothing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. For real.
But that's how it started. It really started by accident.
Yeah.
But during that, so the Milwaukee lists were 2-year lists, all right? And they were 2 years. I mean, it was right down to the button. 2 years, they would start another one. 2 years, start another one. Now, the current list that Milwaukee has is like 10 years old. I mean, you know, but, you know, 2 years was the date, man.
Yeah. And
if you didn't make it in 2 years, you were right back in line.
Yeah.
Having somebody drag you out of the bar to take that exam. But
that's how you do your best, drinking beer.
You know, but during that when I did get my name on the list, you know, the reality sunk in that hey, this could be for real. At the time, I lived in Menominee Falls, just outside of Milwaukee, and so I joined the paid on call department there. So I did start my career as paid on call. And, you know, honestly, it was probably the best decision I made because it allowed me to get firefighter 1 and 2.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, there was firefighter 1, 2, and 3, which.
Yep. You know, I know. My dad has fire 3. He just retired last year, but right. He will not let me live down no matter how long I stay in the fire
service. He stick that up your ass.
I will never get fire 3. So he will always have that up on me.
So I got my fire 1 and 2, and I also got my EMT, which really helped when I got into the academy because, you know, I could, you know, Wednesday was a blow day basically for me because I was already nationally registered.
Yeah.
So So they made us, you know, sit through the class all day.
Yeah. Yep.
But we didn't have to test out at the end, which was a huge benefit, you know?
Oh, it, yeah.
You know, because you didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
You know? Because, again, if you didn't pass EMT, you were bounced. They bounced
you. Yeah. You know, yeah, that's...
chance. So that's kind of how it all started. And, you know, it just went from there.
That's awesome. Yeah, led to a very long and prosperous career that we'll keep getting into. So rolling right into it, we're talking getting your career started. So what did you do as a new firefighter to earn respect of your crew, whether it be in the POC ranks at Menomonee Falls or more kind of focused on Milwaukee, what you did when you started getting there?
So I guess, you know, as a young person, anything you can do to make the workload lighter for the more senior guys and your partners is what you need to do. All right. Literally my first year, I probably spent every, you know, obviously as a probationer, you have a lot of duties that you have to do. I mean, you know, you're cleaning shitters, you know, mopping floors. I mean, you're doing all the housework and you're trying to get that done so that the other guys don't even have to touch it. Right.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of, young guys these days think that, you know, cleaning shitters and, you know, doing all so many other stuff that probationers are responsible for is beneath them. You know, they're like, why do I got to do it, right? But, you know, here's what I was always taught is if I can't trust you as the probationer with the littlest things, like cleaning a shitter or mopping a floor or doing the dishes, then I can't trust you with the bigger things, obviously with my life and everything else that we do in the fire service. So I know some people think that hazing, and don't get me wrong, some guys take it way too far.
Oh yeah. But,
you know, giving probationers jabs and holding them accountable, obviously getting them on the right path are things that obviously I went through, but I also believed in them as a boss. When I got older, right? And it comes down to the little things, right? It comes down to, you guys know that just the smallest of things during an operation can make or break that team. And if I can't bring you on my team because you think you're above cleaning the shitter, well, then guess what? You know, then maybe this isn't the position for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
And hit it right on the head.
My whole first year, I literally spent most of my time on the apparatus floor. I knew every tool inside and out. Every tool was clean. Every single day it was polished. It was, you know, everything was just had to be perfect. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I know some of my the probationers that came on with me, they had people on their shifts that were a little harsher with them. I kind of came into the fire service, at least in the city of Milwaukee, at a pretty unique time. And the reason I say that was when my recruit class came out of the fire academy, was the very first time in Milwaukee Fire Department history that they had a citywide shift come out. All right. So, you know, prior to my academy class, what would happen is, you know, you would probably do, you know, 8 to 10 years in busy companies and then slowly work yourself out of that ring, you know, out of those busy companies to a moderate run total house. And then eventually you got 20 years or 25 and then you were in that outer ring, which, you know, some of those houses at the time were only doing maybe 300 runs a year.
Wow.
And so when I came out of the academy, what the chief at the time did was he did a citywide shift list. So what occurred was we had guys with 20, 25 years who were in those retirement homes, if you want to call them that, shifted down to the hood. And again, you know, at the time, I'm not kidding you, we would get at least one structure fire a day. And if you didn't get a structure fire today, you know, if you got shut out with a structure fire, you would get two or three of them the next day. We had we had very high run volume as far as structure fires.
Yeah.
And you know, just to kind of bring that full circle, guys in the fire service, we learn by making mistakes, correct?
That's right.
And so when you're running that kind of volume, I can say in my 28 and a half years, I never had a perfect fire. I mean, I just never did. It was always something I could have changed or improved on. We always did come back and critique what we did at a fire so that we could improve.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know what? You would improve on what you screwed up on this fire, and then the next fire would come in, and you would have improved on that area. But
you screwed up on another.
Something else would lack, right? you would say, shit, you know, if we force this door instead of that door, or made entry here, and, you know, and you can second guess yourself to death. But by making those critiques and being honest with yourselves is how you get better, right?
Yeah.
But you know what? If you make a mistake, you know, you've learned from that mistake. And I think young kids nowadays, from my experience, feel like they look stupid, right? If they fail on something. And guys, I'm here to tell you, that's how you get better. You go out and you train, you make those mistakes, obviously on the training ground. And again, you're going to make them on the regular fire scene or accident scene or whatever type of incident you're on. You're going to make those mistakes. But you just need to be honest with yourselves and critique and obviously just make yourself better, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, when I had these guys come in, these old-timers, you know, I mean, these are the saltiest dogs you ever wanted to work with, right? And like you would go to one fire and these guys, I mean, they would move with purpose. They didn't run, but they moved with purpose and they knew exactly what the hell they were doing. And, you know, like I'm not saying you shouldn't wear a mask, but, you know, as the probie, you got off the rig, you grabbed the old 5-gallon pump can, right? It wasn't a silver bullet. It was a 5-gallon pump can. And you went with the boss. And There was never a line stretched until that boss told you where to stretch it. You know, unless you saw it ripping out of, you know, the B side, yeah, or something like that, obviously you're going to stretch a line right away. But if there was, I mean, the place could be pushing with smoke and the pipe man would wait by the rig and he would wait for that boss to tell him where to stretch. And the boss and the probie would go and investigate and they would hold that bait with that pump can until that line got stretched and you stretched in. I mean, that's just the way it was. But these old timers, they taught me the trade, you know? Taught you not only how to ventilate, but they taught you why to ventilate, when to ventilate, when not to ventilate. I mean, they went through everything. And they did it for two reasons. For one, they felt that duty to pass the trade on to the young guy. Now, if you were a shithead and you didn't give a shit what they were talking about, obviously those guys would pick up on that right away.
Yeah.
Right? And they wouldn't give you the time of day. And obviously your first year would be terrible because you talk about hazing. You were the guy.
Yeah.
But if you went out and you learned and you were sincere about wanting to learn that job, learning that trade, I mean, these guys would give you every trick in the book. They would teach you. And, you know, in hindsight, I look back and I'm like, you know, these guys really made my career because they not only impressed on me the importance of making sure equipment's operable, making sure it's put back the right way, everything like that, but the duty to pass the trade on to the next guy, you know?
Right.
And I'll tell you what, like I said, these guys, the first fire you had today, that day, they were right on step. Second fire, a little slow. Third fire, they were like, hey, you got this, kid. And, so, you know, from my respect, you know, first of all, I felt that they, you know, these guys felt the duty to pass that trade on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in hindsight, I look back and I'm thinking, they knew as soon as I was up to par and I knew what the hell I was doing, they could back off a little bit.
Yeah.
It's all so, you.
But, you know, as God is my witness, I can't thank those guys. A lot of them are passed away already. But I had some fantastic mentors when I first went to college.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with you saying that, because that's one of our later questions, I'm going to tie it right into that one. So what was some of your most influential members in the fire service? You were just talking about some of them in terms of their, but why as well? You know, you gave a little bit in there, but who sticks out to you the most?
Okay, so, you know what? I don't know that I could pick one person out that was like the person.
Yeah.
And you guys, you know, I know you guys are young and you might have one person now, but at the end of your career, you're going to say, you know what? There were many people that helped form you and take you in the direction of your career.
Absolutely.
I don't know that I could pick out just one person because there were many.
Yeah.
Which kind of instills into you. And what I see now is, you know, I remember when, you know, the old bosses that I had, all right? And I'm talking about guys who probably had 25, 30 years on the job, were lieutenants, captains, battalion chiefs. And I know Beaver Dam and other departments are smaller, but here's the deal. Your job as a boss is to take care of your people. That's it. That's it. And what I mean by take care of them is obviously make sure they're trained to what you think your standard is. Now, I know everybody's got a standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But let's be honest, that standard is so weak. In my opinion, the standard is so weak. If you're just to the standard, you ain't worth shit. Right. I mean, you gotta go above and beyond because that's how you build a team.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what I learned from these old timers. Now, nothing left the house. All right. And I know with social media and, you know, honestly, that's what changed the fire service. You know, your firehouse was your house and your boss was your boss and your boss took care of you.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I was also taught back then that rules aren't really rules. They're just a guideline. All right. And, you know, as long as you can justify what you do in the fire service, nobody has anything on you. Sure, it can be a rule, and sure, you might get your ass bit. But if you can justify what you did, then there's nothing anybody can do to you, all right? Mm-hmm. And with that said, that's how those houses were run. I mean, if your wife called and said, hey, your water heater just blew up, guess what? Your boss would say, go. And you would say, well, boss, we're going to be short. And he'd say, go. Don't worry about that. That's on my end. You just go. And you would go and take care of business and you come back, right?
Yeah.
And what that did was it did a couple of things. First of all, you were ever indebted to your boss for, you know, for taking care of you.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
But it was a family. You know, if that boss's wife called or their kid called and they were stranded on the highway or whatever, you know what? Somebody jump in the front seat and the boss would leave. I mean, it worked for everybody.
Yeah.
There's too many bosses now that go, oh, I might get in trouble. Well, guess what? Get in trouble. This is your family. Do the right thing. You know, DTRT, do the right thing. If you do the right thing, you can never, ever be chastised for that.
Yeah.
And that's how it was in the firehouse. I mean, you know, we had cooks that would go out, and I'm not going to tell you what they did when they would go out, but, you know, they would collect the money and they would go out and they would shop and wouldn't come back till like quarter to noon, you know, throw together a meal at noon. And, you know, I mean, that's just how it was back then. And, you know, sometimes the boss would have to pull them aside and say, don't pull that shit again. But, you know, nothing ever left the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, nowadays you got so many people posting things that are funny and granted they are funny, but everything needs to stay in the house, you know, parking cars in the firehouse against the rules, washing your personal vehicle in the firehouse against the rules. You can go down to, you can go down to the busy companies in the city right now. There's not one company that doesn't allow you to park your car in the firehouse because you'll get stolen by morning. All right. Washing your vehicle. If you're the shithead, guess what? The boss may say, hey, you're not washing your car anymore until you pick your shit up. Right. Yeah. The rest of the guys are washing their vehicles. That is a, in my opinion, a way of giving the guys a break or a data boy for job well done for all the other things that you're asking that person to do. You know, I think there's too many bosses right now that won't stand up for their men or women. And, you know, I remember when I got promoted to lieutenant and they had me raise my right hand and I shit you not, I was thinking, boy, they fucked up. They trusted me, you know, and I had a pretty good career and never did anything or gotten any type of serious trouble. But you know what? I look back now, lieutenant was as high as I went. I did captain, never made it. But I look back and I think to myself, you know what? I had the respect of the men. And that's all a person can ask for when they leave this job.
Right. You know?
So I don't know if that answered the question or if I got a
question. Definitely answered it. Yeah. That was exactly what we're looking for. So going on for what we got to retract my set. There we go. So perfect timing as well with you talking about you're going to lieutenant, getting promoted to lieutenant, especially once you got to that stage where you've got that influence, you got those new guys coming in. How did you motivate those new firefighters?
So going back to what I was taught when I came on the job, you can change a lot of things with training. All right. And what I mean by training is, what people don't realize is the fire service is a team sport. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of guys, you know, and even during my career, there was a time where guys would walk, get training and they would come back and they would just hold all of that training to themselves. And the reason they did that was they thought, you know what, that's a one-upper when I go in for the next promotional exam. Right. And I could never understand that mentality. Because in this business, if I learn something and I don't pass it on to you guys and something happens and now the little bit of information I could have gave you or the training I could have gave you could have saved my life, right?
Yeah.
It just didn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of people from my group. And when I say my group from I would say maybe 90 to 95, that all have the same mentality that, hey, you know what? You know, you don't ask a quarterback on a professional football team to be the running back for the play, right?
No.
Just don't. That's not his lane. And, you know, Brunacini wrote a book about customer service years ago, right? And I'll tell you, you know, in the fire service, before they even coined the term customer service, the fire service was already doing customer service. And here's the example I'd give you. You know, firefighters weren't always paid a lot of money. You know, it was a shit job. You didn't have the wages. You didn't have the benefits that we enjoy nowadays. I mean, you know, I'm going back to the guys that taught me. So, you know, on their off days, you know, these guys built garages. They did roofing. They did concrete work, right? So they would come for their 24-hour shift. And the next day, I mean, they were... hey, we got concrete to pour, man. We're out of here, right? But, you know, these guys, when they went off to their other jobs, you know, they knew that was their lane. So, you know, let's say you would go for a furnace trouble, right? Well, the boss wouldn't go in there and act like he knew everything, right? Yeah. He would turn and he'd say, hey, Joe, you're up, man. Because Joe did heating and air conditioning on his days off.
Yeah.
So now Joe's the expert. What guys need to realize is your boss can't be the expert. Your boss is the guy who details and keeps everybody in line. And by using your people for their strengths is what a boss is to do, right? I mean, that's in my mind, what a good boss does. So,
absolutely.
You know, back to customer service. Hey, Joe, fix Grandma Bushka's furnace here, right? Now, he wouldn't go in there and have parts to fix the thing, but he knew enough, hey, if I cross this circuit and that circuit, we'll get Grandma's furnace running so she doesn't freeze over the weekend. And then we'd instruct her, hey, you know, call the AC guy on Monday. We'd save her the, you know, $100 emergency charge over the weekend.
Yeah. And,
you know, they were ever indebted to you. Yeah. That was customer service, you know? And so even prior to, you know, fire departments getting the buzzword customer service, the fire service already did that, you know? And that's one example, you know? I mean, yeah. There were, you know, examples of that, you know? But I guess the point is you need to build a team, and that team needs to be comprised of people with all different strengths. We all don't have the same strengths, right? So when it's that person's strength is, guess what? You're in the lead position now, buddy, right? And by training and learning the strengths and weaknesses of everybody, I mean, there's nothing you can't get through.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, that's just the way it is. And I really think that there's a lacking in that right now. Even towards the end of my career, I saw bosses who really felt like they needed to know everything. And that's not how you operate. Right. Yeah. You like to think you do. But you know what? There's some areas that I'm not real keen on. And you know what? I'm going to tap somebody else.
Yeah.
So again, I don't know if that answered the question, but you know, there's just a lot of things I think these young guys, and let's face it, you can't go on Facebook nowadays, and I'm not shitting you, every weekend somebody around the country is doing something on leadership. All right. You know, we got this leadership course here and this leadership course here and this one here and this one here. You would think the fire service is the most squared away organization in the flipping world, right? Just because all the
there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Here's my take on it. I've seen guys who are really smart who suck, who absolutely suck at leadership. All right. It is my opinion, and my opinion only. I'm sure there's people out there that don't believe it. You can't teach leadership. You just can't. I can tell you all day long on what to do, right? How to build a team, how to do this, right? And if you physically can't go out there and execute those things that we're telling you to do as a leader, you ain't going to be a good leader.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit how many classes you sit through.
Yeah.
Being a good leader is a personality trait, I think.
Yeah.
To have that servant mentality.
Yeah.
And you know what? Some of the best leaders I've seen in the fire service weren't even bosses.
Mm-hmm. They were
company who obviously had the respect of everybody on that company, including the boss. And, you know, their word was as good as the boss's word. I mean, they just had a lot of experience. They were, you know, and again, those guys, we need those guys.
Mm-hmm.
We need those senior men. Not everybody wants to be a boss. And you know, I just think everybody in the fire service thinks that if you're not moving up the ladder, that you're not doing anything in the fire service. And I think that's an absolute fallacy, because I've seen so many smart, great firemen who are senior men, you know?
Yeah.
And without those senior men, you know, again, that was kind of my impetus to get the Bruce City Fools going, was because not only on the Milwaukee Fire Department did I kind of see, you know, in the busy companies in the inner city, There's a senior man and there are great firemen. You know, obviously we bust each other's chops, but you look at all those busy companies. The reason you could operate the way you did was because you knew those other companies had your back.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of departments will write SOPs, right? And when you get to the scene, they're going up to the chief and saying, hey, what do you need me to do, chief? Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing to do, is to check in with the chief and see what he needs, because his plan might be different than what the SOP dictates. But if it's a fire and you're the second truck, and the SOP is the second truck says you're going to do ventilation or, you know, whatever your SOP states, then as a boss, that's what you're going to do unless told otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, same with engine work, right? And I know I bust your guys' chops about engines and trucks. You know, you guys call everything a truck. you know, I came from engines and trucks are two different pieces of equipment, and they have two very different, you know, duties as far as a fire scene. And,
absolutely.
You know, in the inner city, you knew when you had truck 9 or truck 12, you know, truck 5, you had these truck companies coming in. You knew they had your back, and you knew that they were going to do their best that they could at what they were, you know, told to do. And the same with engine work. You know, first line stretched, second line stretched, you know, I mean, boss coming in and seeing that it's not going so well with, you know, two lines, maybe dropping a 2.5 or, you know, whatever. You know, I think in today's fire service, when they give you a bar or two bars or three bars, you feel like you have to be a much smarter person than everybody on your team. And I don't believe that for one second. All right. I'm the orchestrator. And, you know, I think part of the question was, how do you build that that respect? And I think it's by going out and making mistakes with your men and women in your team. All right. It does two things. It not only, and again, let me just back up one second. If you're going out and you're training and you're not failing, then you're not training hard enough. All right. Because every time you go out, you should be making mistakes. And I don't mean, you know, like just throwing a ladder. I mean, like if you're just throwing ladders and everybody's pulling the halyard and the ladder's going up and you're like, okay, we're done. That's training. That's not training. All right. You need to go out and design your training so that failure's built into it. And what I mean by failure built into it is you're not going to go out and design a training that you know nobody can do. You're going to go out and design a training that is going to be so difficult that it may take you 3, 4, 5 times to accomplish and get to that level, right? But by making those failures the first time and the second time and the third time, you are now gaining knowledge by making those mistakes and obviously figuring out what you have to do to get to that level. And I think people go out and they go, oh, yeah, we threw ladders today. We rose the aerial up today. We dragged some hose line today. That's not training, right? So you need to go out and make those mistakes. Well, guess what? I'm not infallible. I'm just like you guys. I'm the one who gets my ass chewed when shit don't go right. That's it. That's all I am as the boss. Obviously, you know, in some of the houses, it wasn't my quote, but I use it quite often. The chief would say to me, hey, you need to get these guys under control. And you know what my answer to them was? Hey, chief, you can't lose control if you never had it. And God's honest truth. But you know what? Those are the guys you want on your fire department. Right. Those crazy SOBs that'll do anything you ask of them. Those are the guys you want to work with. All right. Mm-hmm. And when you say, hey, we're going to go train, and they say, what are we going to train on? And you tell them, and they go, you know what? How about we do this? Hey, perfect. Let's do this. Right. I mean, it doesn't always have to be my idea. It's a team effort here, fellas. Right. And by going out and making those mistakes with your men and women so that they can see you just as human as they are, taking care of them in the firehouse, not only with firehouse duties, speaking up to battalion chief or assistant chief or whoever up the chain, and, you know, just being there for your people and defending them, you know, that garners a lot of respect from the people that you work with. Right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, I can't say enough. Maybe I should have kept my mouth shut my whole career. Maybe I'd be the flipping chief right now. But but that wasn't in the books, you know. Yeah. And you know, somebody's got to ask the hard questions, and I was that guy. I was the bold. I wasn't much of a finishing guy. I was the bulldozer guy.
Yeah,
and I still am. You know, I still am. So.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head. I mean, it's just it's unfortunate. You see, there's people that talk about, you know, the corporatization of the fire service. Like, everything's just a piece of paper now. Like, it's like you said, everybody, it's goal is to rise, and you're gonna have people. You should have people whose goal is to be chiefs, whose goal is to rise to that. But when all that matters is if you're sitting in a desk and getting that piece of paper that says you got a master's degree and you know, whatever it may be, that carries more weight than 10, 15, 30 years on a job. Like, that's where you got to look at, especially in this line of work. Like, you know, how much is it smartness and how much is a people person and being an actual leader, and what that says more value? Because that experience, that says way more value than that education, but
right,
flipped on what that priority is.
You know, and with that said, you know, where I gained my experience was volume, right? Yep. Obviously, yeah. Milwaukee, we get a lot more volume than what we do in Beaver Dam, right? Not saying you can't be a good boss out here, but you know, when you're doing the volume that we did, either with, I mean, you know, God's honest truth, if we got sent on a garage fire, I was doing everything in my power to get us picked up from that, because in Milwaukee, garage fire was nothing. Yeah. I mean, you would get two of those a day, two or three of those a day. It was just bullshit work, right? I mean, surround and drown. There was really no fun to it. But you know, you got your experience from volume. You messed up a shit ton, but you learned from those mistakes, right? And so that's where, that's where I got my experience from, was screwing shit up, right?
Right.
That's how we all learn, fellas. You know, you got to get out there and make those mistakes. You know, back to what you said, Bryce, there's probably a handful of guys that I had the honor to work with that had degrees. I mean, there were a couple of guys that had master's degrees. A lot of them had bachelor's degrees. And you can imagine with, you know, the roster in Milwaukee, I mean, guys, when I first came on the job in 1990, we had 1,200 firemen. Just over 1,200. It was like 1,265. All right. When I retired, we had about 650. Half of the department was chopped in the 20.
Opposite how shit should be going. Yeah.
It's crazy. And, you know, some of it was low lying fruit. I mean, you know, battalion chiefs had drivers. You know, I mean, there were a lot of positions that they could cut out. You know, a lot of people say, well, why does the battalion chief need a driver? Well, guess what? You know, the driver was the eyes and ears of that battalion chief. I mean, the drivers for the battalion chiefs and the deputy chiefs in Milwaukee when I first came on were probably some of the saltiest dogs you'd ever want to work with. They never went into fires without air packs. They went in, they located the fires. They, you know, I don't want to say did a primary, but I mean, they were the eyes and ears for the battalion chief before company showed up, or even during the operation, you know. A lot of chiefs ran the fire from interior. It was probably in 96, 97, when they started making the battalion chiefs stay outside as the, you know, command in front of the building. But prior to that, your chiefs were inside with you. Yeah. And they were, yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, the job got done. I mean, but, you know, there were a lot of guys who had the degrees and were actual firemen. And when I say a handful of them, there was probably another 300 or 400 that had all the degrees and wouldn't know the working end of a fire hose.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, that is the way the fire service is going today. You know, you don't get any credit for working in those busy companies and making those mistakes now. You know, now you're a battalion chief and you're going to make the mistakes and possibly kill people. Because you don't know any different, right? And then to add on top of that, now you got officers who wouldn't say shit if they had a mouthful. And so when the battalion chief gives them an order, which, you know, anybody with any speck of knowledge would know it's not a good order, instead of telling the battalion chief to pound sand, they just go ahead and they fill out that order. And, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, unless something changes, and I think we're going to see a lot more line of duty deaths, you know, around the country, because a lot of young kids are coming into the business. And let's face it, it's a blue collar job.
Yeah, absolutely.
White collar job. It's a get dirty, get out there, you know, pull ceilings. I mean, you got to be aggressive. You got to be smart, and you got to be willing to get dirty.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have those things and you just want to wear a t-shirt and go to school, and guys, you know, and I know I'm kind of aging myself, but you know, back, and again, I got nothing against formal education. I really don't.
Yeah, absolutely.
During my career, I, you know, when I came on, I already had three kids. I was married. You know, it just wasn't in the cards for me to go to school. And honestly, you know, with the mentors that I had, the old timers, they were like, kid, you don't need all that schooling. We're going to teach you how to not only keep yourself alive, but keep your company alive, keep the whole, you know, battalion alive, you know.
Yeah.
And those are the skills that I think people are lacking, you know. You know, if I said to you guys, hey, would you guys believe I'm a bodybuilder? See?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a bodybuilder. I read a couple books about it, right?
Yeah.
You physically go out there and do the goddamn work, you're not ever going to be a bodybuilder. It's no different. Fire service. You can go to all the classes you want. And, you know, now all you got to do is sit at home behind a damn computer screen. You don't even have to show up at the damn school. You know, you might have to one time for, you know, a test out, but most of it's done online. You know, but, you know, the point I'm trying to make is everybody thinks by going to school and getting all of these certs and, you know, getting all of this education is going to make them a better fireman. And I, and again, it's my opinion. It's not going to make you a better fireman. You need to get out there. You need to make mistakes. You need to train. You need to not only train, but you need to push yourself. Your training so far. And again, put it at an attainable level. But you need to go out and make those mistakes and keep working towards that goal. And then when you get to that goal, guess what? Now the bar gets raised higher.
Yep.
And how you become good at this job is getting your hands dirty, getting out there, and just doing the damn work that we're responsible for. That's all, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So. Couldn't have said it better myself. Absolutely. It's... Like I said, can't wait and so excited to have you have all this time on here. So beautiful answers in there. We got our next one. What do you think brings a crew together the best?
You know, I think a crew gets you together the best is when it's not just, you're not just spending 24 hours a day or 48 hours a day. It's when you know, you get off of work and, you know, you go to a concert or you go to a baseball game or you do things together. And not just us, you know, as the firefighters, you know, it's with your significant others, you know, with the families, you know, having picnics, that thing. You know, and this might come across in the wrong way. And I've had this discussion with many people before. And again, when I came on the job, most of the guys I worked with, their wives didn't work. All right. And the reason their wives didn't work was because they were raising the children. Okay. So what occurred is that, you know, you would come in, you'd work your 24-hour shift. Well, me being the young guy, right, I was like fresh meat to all these guys in the firehouse, right? And the reason I was the fresh meat was because Al had a roofing business and John did concrete and this guy did, you know, rehabs. And so on my off days, John would hire all the guys from the firehouse and all of us would go and we'd roof that house that day and he'd pay us, right? And then the next day we were helping this guy with the concrete and the next day we were helping this guy, right? And so it did a couple things for you. It helped you with your side jobs and by getting those side jobs, you it would allow you or your wife not to work, because now you were the breadwinner. All right. And obviously, in lieu of your wife not working, you got to make that income up somehow. When I first started, that's how it was. The women stayed home. And again, please don't take this the wrong way. I'm not like this male chauvinist pig that thinks women need to stay home. All right. I'm just telling you how it was. The women stayed home. But then on the weekends, because all of us were together all week, not only at the firehouse, but doing the roofing job and the concrete job and, you know, the rehab or, you know, whatever. We would go over to somebody's house. We'd stoke up the grill. All the kids would run together. We'd have the grill going. We'd be hitting some cocktails. The wives would be hitting the cocktails. It was family. Yeah. Right. And now, you know, later in my career, you know, somebody would put something up on the board and they'd say, hey, I got a roofing job. I need some help. And the answer was, oh, you know what? I got to watch the kids that day, or my wife's going to be out of town on business that day, or this or this. And so obviously through the years, what occurred was the husband worked, the wife worked to pay for this huge house that they want and the brand new cars that they want. And they didn't have any time to spend with their crew, which now you're not blending or mending like we did back in the day. And I think that's where the culture of the fire service is kind of dying, right? And I'm not saying it's from your spouse's working. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying is, in order to be a family, in order to have the respect of each other, we need to stay together as a family. And that's by doing things on our off shifts as well, not just at work. It's by doing things on the off shift as well, right? And which brings it full circle back to when you're working is, you know that I got your back and I know you got my back, because it's not just a, hey, Bryce, how we doing? We work for 24 hours and I don't see you for 48, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like punching a clock. It's, hey, we're family. And, you know, with that said, when it's family and, you know, Brennan or Bryce or me, if we have a problem, guess what? We're man enough that we can just walk over in a corner and we can hammer this out, right?
Yeah.
There should be no hard feelings. I mean, obviously, most of the times people are pissed off at each other is from a misunderstanding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, I absolutely, yes.
And, you know, everything gets blown out of proportion. So, yeah. You know,
it's crazy. With social media, everything like that, it's so not hard at all for that stuff to, like, it's just a game of telephone, but on a wide scale stage. Like, you can, one person says one thing and then six people later through text and calling and face or whatever it is, it's like, oh, totally different things.
Like, just make a phone call. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Just talk to the person, go to the source. Go to the source.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to me, that's what we're lacking too, is, you know, it's just like, let's be human about this and just talk it out.
Yeah.
You know, And if we can't come to an agreement, at least we can agree to disagree, you know?
Yeah.
We know where each other stands, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, I mean, I'm very fortunate in the career that I had. We trained a lot, you know, we trained every day. And what I mean by train every day, you know, it can get cold here in Wisconsin. I'm not making the guys go out to train at, you know, 20 below zero just because we're going to. No, that's bullshit. I don't want to train at 20 below zero, right? But then what we did was we did something in-house, you know? And it might have been something as simple as, you know, hey, 10:30, everybody to, you know, the rig. And we go through every single compartment and we go through all the tools on there, right? The young guys, you know, pitching them, say, hey, guess what? Next shift, you're in charge of training. You know, and that's how you develop your guys. Let them develop the training do the training. And, you know, it does a couple things for them. It gets them their head into the book, where normally they're just regurgitating what you told them. But now if they're in charge of the training, now they actually got to put it together, you know. So there's a lot of different tools you can use as a senior man or company officer to to get everybody together. And obviously the young kid, when he's in charge of training, everybody's going to bust his chops. But what it does is it opens that dialogue amongst everybody on the team. And not only did that kid learn by actually having to look up and, you know, different things on a certain topic. But now you've got all the other guys who have already made mistakes possibly in that topic that are adding things into it. And it turns out to be some of the best training you'll ever do, you know? But in my mind, training is the win all the way around. With keeping the peace amongst you, you know, let's face it, idle hands and the devil are two of the same things, right? And, from my experience, a lot of the houses that had a lot of problems were the houses that were slow because they had nothing else to do but bitch about each other, about what this one went dead. The houses in the inner city and the hood, shit, they ran like Swiss watches. Everybody trained. It was a race to get to the fire. You knew your role when you got there because you were either first engine, second engine, third engine, you know, first truck, second truck. You knew from your positioning of when you got there what your duties were going to be. Obviously, the chief could alter that depending on how the situation was going. Yeah. But, those first initial companies were probably right on mark with the way the SOP was written, you know. But I just can't say enough about training. And, with that said, that's what kind of got me involved with teaching at the University of Illinois. I actually was sent on a recon mission down there. I, believe it or not, I had already had my my technician level for structural flaps out of Texas A&M. And my boss had money to send six people down to the University of Illinois to their program, to their structural flaps program. And he said, hey, I want you to go. And I said, Terry, I've already got my technician level. Why don't you send somebody else and, allow them to get that training and obviously get paperwork on it. Because in my mind, I felt it was better for the team to have more guys trained to that level.
Yeah.
He said, no, I get it. He goes, but you took your technician level at Texas A&M. I want you to go down there and take this class so that we can compare and see which class is better. So in 2005, I went down there. We went through class. Obviously, in my mind, it was hands down a much better class than what I took at Texas A&M. And not saying Texas A&M doesn't do a great job, but when I went through the class, I was like, if I had to pick one, it would be U of I. And so then that's where we started sending all our people down there. Well, while I was down there, I might have made a few friends. And I told the boss, Mac McCaslin, God rest his soul, who is another mentor of mine, I said, hey, boss, if you ever have any positions for an instructor down here, I'd love to come and work for you. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, I do have positions. And I got hired. And I'll tell you, when I got hired as an instructor, and I first started out with structural flaps down there. I'm teaching other classes now, but structural flaps was my first one. It was kind of for selfish reasons. And what I mean by that was I knew they had instructors from all over the country coming in to instruct them. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how cool would it be to go down there and not only be an instructor, but more importantly, learn from firefighters from all over the country. And I was like, this is going to be awesome. And, I went down there and again, probably the first 5-6 years, I was the probie, right? I mean, it was no different. I was a young guy on the roster. I got all the shit jobs, did everything to the best of my ability, showed them that I had some drive, showed them I wanted to instruct. And obviously they started putting me in those roles. And, now I'm the fucking senior guy down there, right? I've been down there for 17 years. But the nice thing about the University of Illinois is unlike, the tech schools around here, we as the instructors write the curriculum. So You know, example I'll give you, if we're doing something in structural collapse that we did 10 years ago that isn't relevant anymore, and I shouldn't say isn't relevant, it's something we feel they'll pick up throughout their career with training from their own home teams, and we think something is more valuable to teach them the basics now in, we'll change the curriculum, you know? And a lot of schools, you know, i.e. the tech system and everything, don't have that luxury. You know, they hand you a curriculum and they say, teach this, you know, is where we're the ones who actually wrote the curriculum. And, you know, fortunate for us, we write down what we want. We send it off to curriculum, right? Because they have a curriculum department at the U of
M. Yeah.
And obviously through phone calls and video chats and everything else, we get it squared away, nibbled down to where, okay, here's the curriculum, and boom, it comes out. And then the very next class, we're teaching that. You know,
that's nice.
It's a great opportunity. You know, selfishly, I started out there for selfish reasons. Learned a shit ton from guys from all over the country. I can't say enough about that. You know, I mean, it was living a dream. You know, we all say that, but honestly, it really was, you know. So,
yeah. That's what we talked about in our first episode. It's basically the same selfish reason we started this, is to bring all those people. I mean, I think we talked about with last episode with Jeremy, Jeremy Sanders, like the fire service itself is so unique and receptive to sharing that information with those right people. You know, the people that are passionate about this job, you could talk to them like they're your guy that you've been working with 20 years. Like I told Jeremy, I said, when we went to his training in Campbellsport with him and Sean Duffy, it was like, he was a celebrity to Brent and I. Like I didn't talk to him in person. I waited and cowered behind a phone. I was like, if he responds to this, he responds. If not, whatever. And then like talking to him and everybody else, all of a sudden, from what this has branched into, you realize that the people that you want to hear from are the people that want to share their information. And it's just, they're all out there. They're all normal guys and girls. Like, they're all just firefighters. And they got so much knowledge to share. There's so much stuff out there. You just got to go out and get it.
And you know what that said? The way you can really tell a true fireman is just what you said. If they want to share their information freely, that is a sign of a true firefighter. All right. And what I mean by that is I'm not saying somebody shouldn't make some money. And what I mean by money is just compensation. Because let's face it, they're leaving their family for the weekend. They're making trades. They're taking vacation days. They're doing all that. That's, in my mind, where the compensation is for, right? It's not for the information we're sharing.
Exactly.
You know what? Everything that any one of us as instructors is sharing is shit that obviously it's changed over years, depending on building construction types and, you know, everything else. But let's face it, all the shit that we're all sharing is shit that everybody's been doing for 100 years, right? They might've found a little better way to do it from mistakes by getting out in training, right? But, you know, if you look at the bare bones of firefighting, it hasn't changed. You know, a left-hand search pattern hasn't fucking changed in 100 years, right? Are there better ways than just a left-hand or right-hand? Absolutely, you know? So, you know, sharing that information freely is, you know, those are the people that I love to sit down and drink beer with. And when I say that, you guys know that I like to indulge a little bit. I can tell you that I've learned more over, you know, some cold ones with instructors at these conferences than you do actually sitting through their, you know, four-hour gig, you know. When you can get somebody down to their basic level, and again, not saying, you know, like when I present, you got me at your basic level when I'm on this stage. But obviously when you have a couple more beers, that basic level might drop a little. But you guys know what I'm saying. Those are the leaders in the fire service. All right. And those are the guys that will come out and tell you, this is a way, right? There's many ways to to do it. This is a way. It may work for your depending on, you know, the size of your department, your staffing, what types of rigs you run, you know, what's first out the door. All of those things factor into it, you know. Yeah. But by learning those different ways, you're able to take what they kind of broke down and maybe even break it down one or two more times to make something work better for your department, you know.
Yep.
And, you know, by doing that and sharing that information and sharing those tricks and, you know, experiences, things that you know absolutely are not going to work, you know, those are the types of guys you want to sit down and have a beer with. Because not only are they a hoot to have beer with, but, you know, everybody's on the same plane, right? They're humble. Yep. They're just, they love to get their hands dirty. They're blue collar workers, just like you and I, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, you know, you can't say enough about that.
Yeah. And I'll throw this in here because it'll give you a chance to give a little shout out for your hard work on this, because you touched on it briefly, but that was one of my earliest kind of influences that I got when it came to the Brew City Fools trainings. Because the first couple that I went to, I was not on Beaver Dam. I was on town, came down with my buddy and, you know, got to meet you, JD, a lot of those guys that start to help out with in the future. But the first RIT training that I went to, I remember every single station started off with, this is a way, not the way.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it was just such an early influence. It was one of the actual first formalized fire chants I went to outside of like getting my tech college certs, and just realizing that there really is all these other ways that you can do it, and having all those instructors with the same mindset of like, you know, this is how we're teaching you to do it today. This is a way that we found that works, but if you got something better, we want to hear it. And that was, it was such a good starter from that. And so I'll let you run with that a little bit. I know you got lots of stories.
Like I said, a shout out to Southside Fools out of Chicago, because obviously we're not at the university. Most of the guys I worked with, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of the guys I worked with, we're from Chicagoland area, either on Chicago or in suburbs. And they had Southside Fools up and running. And so for the first couple of years, I would drive down to Chicago to sit in on their meetings. And, you know, Mac McCaslin, who I mentioned earlier, Mac was a retired chief out of Oak Lawn. And he was the number two guy at the university for Fire Institute. And Mac was one of those guys. I don't think I ever saw him get angry the whole time I knew him. He was just very level-headed. When you asked him a question, he just didn't give you a quick answer. He gave you a thoughtful answer, right, on why certain things are done certain ways, which, you know, sometimes we all see things happening, but we don't see the other side of it. And obviously on our end, we're like, what the hell are we doing here? Right. So Mac was just one of those types of guys who could make you understand the middle ground. But Mac McCaslin, and honestly, I don't know when Southside Fools started, but that was the reason why I started a chapter up here, was from going to their meetings. And let's face it, right now, nobody, and I shouldn't say nobody, Illinois, I don't know how the hell they get all the grant money for training. But, you know, not all states are like Illinois, and not all departments can afford training anymore, right?
Absolutely. I mean,
first thing that falls off is, hey, we got to do this, we got to do that. The training budget is shit, right? And, you know, in my mind, I'm like, you know what? I teach with all of these firemen from all over the country. You know, to do a weekend gig with you know, guys from New York or this or that, you know, these guys will come and share their knowledge for free. Obviously I'm going to pay them something. We'll put them up, pay for their beer for the weekend, you know, stuff like that. And that's what Southside Fools was doing. And what it did was it allows people to get trained that they normally wouldn't have the money for. And not only not have the money for, but again, to try and push their training to a different level, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have the same person doing the training in your department, every year it's going to be the same, right? Because that's their mentality about training. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. They've got a can. They don't have to worry about it, right? I know next month is you know, ropes or whatever. They don't have to put any effort into it. And so typically what happens is a department will get stagnant. You get stagnant with their training. And obviously I witnessed it in different companies in Milwaukee. So the impetus to get Bruce City Fools here was to bring individuals from different departments to share their knowledge. And again, you know, I said it earlier, as the boss, I didn't know everything, right? And guys have heard me tell this story. We call them head scratchers, right? We've all been to that run where we pull up and you get off and you're like, what in the fuck are we going to do with this? I mean, whether it's an auto extrication, confined space, you know, a rope job, whatever, right? You're the head scratcher, right? Mm-hmm. And so I learned this from a good friend of mine, Terry, and we dubbed it the Mad Minute, all right? And so when I got off the rig, and if you guys were my firefighters and you heard me say Mad Minute, do you know what that told you? It told you immediately I had no clue what the fuck we were going to do.
Yeah, I think this one through.
As the boss, I am fortunate that I trained you guys to be team members, right? So when I'd say Mad Minute, it did two things for me. It immediately told these guys that, hey, I don't know what we're going to end up doing here, but I need some ideas, right? Mm-hmm. Because I always say this, I don't always have the right idea, but I'll know it when I hear it. All right.
Yeah. And
so when I called out Mad Minute, what that allowed everybody on my team to do was start giving me ideas. All right. Now I'm the boss, so I get to pick the final idea. Right. But you know, it might be half of this guy's idea, half of his.
And yeah, exactly.
But the point that I tried to make and the objective I tried to do was if I can get you guys working on a shit pile of whatever the incident is within 1 minute of time, guess what? We're already starting to head towards the win column, right? It drives me crazy when I see companies pull up and literally it's like a flipping union meeting where 15 minutes down the road, they're still deciding what they're going to do. Right? It's like, no, come up with plan A. And, you know, the chief would come up and say, well, what's your plan B? And, you know, the chief finally figured it out. Don't ever ask me about plan B, because guess what? I don't know what fucking plan B is. All right. And there's nothing wrong with that. I have full faith in you as my team members, as my crew, as people that I'm directing. And again, through training and talking and everything else, I have full faith that if you run into an obstacle, you know, while we're trying to navigate through plan A, that you're going to improvise, you're going to adapt, you're going to overcome the problem, and you're going to continue, right? But if I come up with plan A and I think about what plan B is and plan C, I don't know what plan B is because I don't know what I'm going to run into yet. But within 1 minute, if I can get you guys rowing the boat in one direction, we're already headed towards that wind column. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely.
And that's...
I like that.
That comes down to training, you know? I mean, you get out and you train. You see the weaknesses. You see the strength of everybody. And me as the boss, all my job is to focus everybody on whatever problem we have, right? I don't need to know the right answer. The people that I'm working with, somebody has the right answer. And that's where I see the fire service lacking is... We have too many young lads, and I shouldn't even say young lads, too many young bosses who don't want their people doing anything until they're told to do it, right? I worked in overtime one time, right? It wasn't in my own company. I was detailed out to another company. I got there, and we got sent on a garbage cart fire, right? You know, like garbage carts.
Yeah.
In Milwaukee, you know, those are dime a dozen. You would probably, you know, if you went for one, you were going to get 10 of them in the alley because some jagoffs lighting garbage carts and they're walking down the alley. So you put out this one, you pull down, and you just keep putting garbage carts out, right? So I was detailed to a company. I'm not going to give the number. And we had a garbage cart. Well, shit, I wasn't even dressed. It's a damn garbage cart. I'm not even getting out of the rig, right? And the kid got off the rig and he stood there. And I look out my window. I go, what are you doing? He goes, what do you want me to do? And I go, why don't you get a can and put that fire out? And he grabs it, puts the fire out. So he gets back in a ring and I go, hey, what's up with that? He goes, what do you mean? I go, well, there's fire. There's a pump can. You wet stuff. Wet stuff.
Yeah.
He goes, well, my boss doesn't let me do anything unless I'm told. And I looked at him and I said, if I got to fucking tell you to put that fire out with a pump can, you're absolutely useless to me. Right?
Yeah.
We have to expect that our firefighters not only will work within the team, but they will also work independently and make smart decisions, right? And again, that comes through training. If
absolutely,
if you do something that I didn't like, I can't chew your ass for it unless we trained on it and I specifically told you I don't like it, right? I mean, that's right. Right?
Yeah.
But, you know, if I see you do something that I think was either sketchy or it could have got, you know, other people in trouble or the team in trouble or something like that, obviously we're going to address it. And how do we address that? We address that with training. And, you know, not only training on whatever, but explaining to you why we don't want to do those types of things, right? Because they're either going to get us in trouble or they're going to get other companies in trouble, right? But once we've trained on it, and once I know you have the knowledge, well, guess what? If you do it again, guess what? Now you're going to get your ass chewed, right? But, you know, I can't say enough to build a team. And, you know, as the boss, you're not the boss. You're one of them. You're just the guy who's going to take the ass chewing, and you're the one who's going to give them the praise of a good job, right? I mean, it's all them when it's good. It's all you. It's only you when it's bad. That's the way it should be run. Right.
Well put. Yeah. Well put. So. That's fantastic. Yeah. Next one we got on here, going right into talking about some of the stations on there. We won't ask you for your lease. You don't gotta go there. But what was your favorite? I already feel like I know the answer, especially with your experience and where you ended up. But what was your favorite house to be out of at MFD?
Yeah. You know, I gotta say, hands down, it was Rescue 2.
Yep.
And, you know, a little story about that. So, you know, Milwaukee never had, up until 2012, we never had dedicated rescues. We just had engine companies, truck companies. We did have, we had Rescue 1, which was just ran out of a special ops house, but it was a jump rig. It carried all our special operations equipment. It had equipment on there for firefighting, but really, you know, not the things you would normally have on a firefighting rig that you would need at, you know, most fires. So it was all specialty equipment. And so, you know, if we got a tech rescue run, the guys on the truck would jump on the rescue and we'd pull the rescue and, we'd pull the engine. And we also had a tractor trailer there at the time, which also carried special operations equipment. But Paul Conway, who was one of my bosses years ago, had the opportunity to work with Paul. Great guy, good fireman, good businessman. That was always one of Paul's dreams, was to have dedicated rescues in the city of Milwaukee. And he would bend a lot of ears, even when he was a captain, when he was a battalion chief. He just didn't have enough horsepower to get that done. And then Paul was then promoted to assistant chief. And I guess you could say all the stars aligned, because obviously Paul was still pushing for it. And obviously he had an uphill battle, because at the time they were making cuts and, you know, all the other things that budgets do to a fire department. And it just was always on the back burner. When the city of Milwaukee, they commissioned for a study. And the study was to basically see if they could make cuts anywhere else to make sure that they had, you know, enough fire protection. And when that study came out, the study said that we had, at the time, we had 36 engine companies. It said that the optimal amount was 32 engine companies. All right. So In other words, they told the city you can cut 4 engine companies and you'll still be good. All right. We had 17 truck companies at the time. And what that study said was that we were 2 truck companies heavy, but the study also said that we were 2 rescues light. So it was like the perfect timing for Paul to step in and say, hey, here's the deal. It's cost neutral, right? We're going to dump 2 truck companies, but we're going to pick up 2 rescue companies. And so that's what occurred in 2012. So, you know, fortunate for me, I got a call from Paul and asked me if I would be a lieutenant on Rescue 2. And obviously I took it. But, you know, it was one of those things. I don't want to say we had to tiptoe because, you know, with the guys that I was allowed to bring on board with me, I don't think any of us know the term tiptoe. But what I mean by that was in order just to fly, because remember, you got people from other people from the department who want to see us fail. They want to see us fail. I don't know if they wanted to see it fail for what reasons, but obviously they didn't want the rescue concept to work in Milwaukee. They wanted those 2 truck companies back. So certain individuals were picked to start those companies. I was fortunate enough to be and honored to be one of them. But from that, we knew that if we didn't set the bar super high, the whole program was going to fail, right? And we would get no respect from anybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I say tiptoe, we had to, I mean, we trained every day. We'd invite companies from surrounding areas to come train with us. Some would come, some wouldn't. I think the battalion chiefs, I don't want to say they wanted to see it fail, but obviously they had questions that they were concerned about how to use the rescues. We were able to kind of educate them on what our role would be as a rescue.
Yeah.
And once we got everything kind of squared away, I don't want to say it was smooth sailing after that, because let's face it, you'll always have a target on your back if you're on that rescue. You're always going to be held to a higher example, which is fine because that's what we thrive on. But I think once everybody realized how much we did train, how much we try to perfect things, I think it really opened the eyes of a lot of people. And in some respects, I think that ripple effect that people talk about, I think other companies started to step their game up.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think it was a great addition to the Milwaukee Fire Department, and still is. The only problem we have with the rescues, let me backtrack a little, just speaking with some individuals recently, not a lot of people want to be in special ops anymore, which kind of goes back to, I think the younger culture. I mean, they want to come into work, they want to put their shift in, and they want to leave, right? They want to wear the T-shirt, they don't want to train. It's just what it is. I mean, I'd be out of my mind right now if I was still working. I think what it did was it brought up all the other companies as well. Not saying they were anything lacking, but, you know, when you see a company out training every single day, and then they come in, and not only are they training, but when they come in and they execute like a team and knock the shit out of the park every time they come. And again, when I say knock it out of the park, nobody knows that we screwed up. Only we know we screwed up. To them, it looked like we knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
And then we go back and we critique ourselves and we get better, right? But I really think for the Milwaukee Fire Department, it brought people up. And what it does is it's an avenue for young firefighters to come in and say, you know what? If I learn the trade, if I get into special ops, I'm not only going to learn all of these different rescue techniques, but I'm going to learn auto extrication. I'm going to learn all of this cool shit. and maybe at some point have the opportunity to actually ride on the rescue, right? It gives them another avenue to get dirty, to get their hands dirty, to get out and get more training. And you know what? You know, when you start to get into that lane and you start to do more, it's very contagious, man. You go out, you do cool, you do fun shit. I mean, there's nothing cooler than when you pull up and all the other firemen are standing around waiting for you. Because you are the only ones with the proper equipment. You're the only ones with the proper training. And, you know, but at the same time, you're under the microscope. So you better fucking get out of the park, right?
Your job.
But the problem we had in special ops is when you get hard chargers like that, they promote out. All right. So they get up there, they get all that education. They see how we built teams. They see how we manage, how our leadership style is not just me, it's the team. And then what they do is the next time a driver promotion comes up or a lieutenant promotion, they promote out.
Yeah.
They do well on the exam because they're wired tight, high-speed, low-drain kind of individuals, and now we send them out in the field. The benefit of it, you know, that's the downfall is they promote out. The benefit of it is by teaching young guys like yourself to take care of the men and women of your team first, it might entail taking an ass chewing from either deputy chief, battalion chief, whatever, but take care of your people. We are now starting to change that culture in the outside world. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's sure.
So getting people in on that, on the special ops, I don't want to say it was hard because we had a lot of individuals that wanted to be part of that team and grow in their fire service careers. But it also helped kind of funnel that mentality out to the rest of the department, which hopefully at some point will start to take back over.
Yeah.
So, but Rescue 2 by far was the best company. We had great firemen there. Obviously, Brian McNulty was the captain, still is the commander there. Brian and I go way back, and you guys probably heard this story. Brian at one time was my driver when I was a lieutenant on Engine 12. Brian was my driver. And I'll tell you what, that guy's got – he remembers shit that I forgot, and as my captain, he would bring it up. And we would sit and laugh and laugh. I'm like, how the hell did you remember that? Because, you know, once it brings it up, you remember it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, you know, it just wasn't in my head, but it was always in his head. But I can't say enough about Brian. Steve Shear, who was the other lieutenant on the other ship, another stand-up guy. The guys on the engine, Chris Vogt, was my partner on the engine, on Engine 24. Chris, another rock-solid fireman. I mean, we just had rock-solid people.
Absolutely.
And again, there were times where we had a battalion chief in quarters. And, you know, we'd get these young battalion chiefs in there. And, you know, obviously the guys, they would say to me, they'd say, hey, we're getting a new BC. We're getting a new BC. How is shit going to change? You know, I'm like, it's not going to change. We're not changing for somebody, right? Mm-hmm. So the conversation usually went like this. Is the BC would be there on his first shift, and I would go into his office and I'd say, hey, can I have a word with you, sir? And he'd say, yes. And I'd shut the door and I would proceed to tell him, hey, here's the deal. there's a lot of shit out there that you might not want to see. All right. And if you don't want to see it, then stay in your office. But my job is to make you look like a star. And as a BC, I will absolutely make you look like a star. I will never disrespect you in public. I will never do anything to make you look like, you know, like an idiot. I will carry through on any orders that I'm given. But my job is to make you look like a star. And not me, but this team will make you look like a star. But for that, you're going to have to put your blinders on. And most of the battalion chiefs, but hey, I'm okay with that, you know, because again, I never would go to the battalion chief with a small problem. In fact, I don't think I've ever went to a battalion chief. I handled all the problems at my level in-house, right?
Yeah.
And again, that kind of goes back to, if you can keep all your problems in-house, whether they're good or bad or whatever, that's the way it needs to be handled, right? Yeah. The minute shit's getting out about, you know, I mean, you know, like we said earlier, it's stupid shit. But then that puts a spotlight on you, and you never want to be on anybody's radar. Yep. And, you know, the guys there, same thing. I, you know, obviously I would never disrespect them. They would never disrespect me, but I was just one of the guys. And I'm sure they'll tell you that because, we just had a great crew there. I mean, good guys. You know, we had a lot of fun both on and off the job.
Absolutely.
You miss it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll move on down to kind of our closing questions there. So I kind of explained it to you a little bit before we got in. So each month, come January, we're really excited. We're doing twice monthly, but basically each of our guests, we were going to ask a question of them to come up with. So what question did they have for you? What question will you have for the next one? And so on, just to get a kind of outside one, as most of our stuff is geared at the new firefighters and what questions they have. But we know that being senior firefighters, officers, retired, whatever it be, you probably have a question that's never been answered or that you wish you asked sooner. So I told you this was a loaded one that we had from Jeremy Sand as our last guest. And his question is can be taken very many different ways. And I hope you take it down every rabbit hole that it could possibly go down. But what is my purpose as a firefighter? Why am I here? When I walk in day one, why am I here?
So, thanks for nothing, Jeremy. It is a rabbit hole that you could go down for hours, right? but I think at heart, when we all come on to this project, we feel that we're going to come and we're going to make a difference, right? I mean, in its entirety, that's why we do it, right? You know, to all of us who love this job, it's not a job, it's a calling. I mean, it really is, right? It's to help people on their worst day ever. And when you say you come in and, you know, on your first day is why I'm here, is you guys know, you guys felt the same way. You want to do good. You want to make grabs. You want to, you know, you want to be the best that you could be, right? And after about 2 months of being on the project, it's like, all right, screw that shit, right?
People suck. This is awful.
Right. It's like I've been up 6 times after midnight for, you know, just bullshit, right?
Chapped and feet. So, that was my best Milwaukee call. Chapped feet.
Right. So your empathy and your passion just start to dwindle. Right? And that's where it really becomes hard, I guess, as a firefighter to stay focused. And I don't want to say that's where I excelled, because I didn't really ever excel at anything. but that's where you really need to continue to stay motivated. And what I mean by motivated is I was always taught the more you can do for your department, you know, acting up, learning how to pump, you know, I mean, just all the things and opportunities we have in the fire service. That is how you make yourself not only a better firefighter, but that's how you make yourself more valuable to the team, right? And I hope you guys, heard me today talk about the team, because I can't stress that enough.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
It's a team sport, you know, and, the minute we start thinking that one person is better than the other, is the team falls apart, right? As soon as we start thinking about personal stats or grabs or this or that, you know, if you look at anything in the fire service, if you didn't have the engine crew making a quick hit on the fire, or, you know, getting to that fire quickly, as the rescue company, you would have never been able to make that grab, right? And so not only do you have an internal team as your company, but you also have to think about the bigger picture as a team and a department. Mm-hmm. And I can't stress it enough. The more I got disgruntled about what we were really doing or what we weren't doing, I guess you could say, about making a change in the community. And, you know, Beaver Dam kind of renewed my faith in that because it is a smaller community, you know. So when you talk to people, when you're doing things, people actually appreciate it. As we're, you know, a bigger city, people really don't care. They don't care if you got one guy on a rig. All they care about is that rig showed up in front of the house when you dialed 911. I mean, let's face it, that's the reality of it. But, you know, I guess to kind of answer Jeremy's question is I got in it to help people, much like we all did. We all felt invincible. Hey, we're going to go and help people. We're going to make their day better. And you know, in reality, we still do that, right?
Yeah.
In our minds, you know, and let me just back up for a second. You know, I've been to a lot of fires at a lot of places that you walk in and it's like these people had absolutely nothing, right? But that was their world. And they just lost their whole world in a fire, right?
Yeah.
And believe it or not, there is still some empathy and compassion left in this hardened asshole body of mine. but, you know, if you break it down to that level, these people, they had nothing and they lost nothing, in my opinion. But in their mind, they lost everything.
Yeah.
You know? But when I say, you know, I got in it to help people, all that happened was my focus changed a little bit from helping the people that I originally thought I was going to be able to help to, and granted, we still do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We're still there within a short period of time when somebody's got an emergency. So I don't want to take that away from anybody. But what it did for me was it changed my focus. And my focus is not only helping those people, but back to that team. I am now motivated to help those individuals who are either my peers, i.e. other lieutenants, go to that next level of captain, young firefighters, help them to learn the trade, team members to build a more cohesive team. So, you know, in effect, I'm still helping people, you know, as my career went on, it just changed from helping the people in the community, which obviously we still do, and that's still the main focus, is to get out into that community, help educate, you know, help them on the worst day of their life. By far, that is the reason why we all got into this. When you see some of the atrocities we've seen, sometimes that focus and that motivation leaves you because you're like, I can't believe I signed up for this, that we're doing all this bullshit work day in, day out. But that's why I say your motivation's got to keep focusing towards training, because whether you think you're helping people or not, the danger of our job is going to always be there. And, you know, I don't care how much you train, something bad can happen. You can train as much as you want, and there's always going to be that one incident that something happens that you didn't account for. And it, you know, it's nothing against you. It's nothing against your team. It just can happen. You know, last week was a prime example. We had a great fireman who was killed in a collapse. Obviously I wasn't there, so I'm not even going to, you know, try and determine what happened there, but obviously something bad happened. We lost a really good fireman who was very well trained, very well respected throughout the fire service. Right?
Absolutely, yeah.
But, you know, I guess to answer Jeremy's question, we all get into this business for the same reason, and that is to help our communities, to help people in their worst state. Sometimes we stray from that, right? But we have to sit down and do some internal thought and try to bring ourselves back to that line. Obviously you'll never get back to that line, and that's just my own opinion, but we need to have some sympathy and compassion when we do this work. or we're just never going to be any good, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
But like I said, you know, the focus changes from not only helping, you know, the people in a community, but also helping the individuals, not only with fire department stuff, but obviously with their personal lives, right?
Yeah.
You know, we all have issues, and, you know, I'm very fortunate that, you know, I had a lot of great firemen, and we all had great respect for each other. And if somebody had a problem, I could notice it right away. And it's something just sitting down with them, letting them be able to bounce some ideas off you, or, you know, a problem you may have, and maybe giving them some, you know, some advice on how to deal with it. You know, you're still helping people. It just might not be the people you originally thought you were there to help. Does that make sense?
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah, I think just even by doing that, you do help those people that you want. Because, I mean, we all talk about it. Well over half, especially nowadays, half our calls are those ones that we call BS. And whether maybe that's not BS to that person, or maybe it is, unfortunately, there's people that abuse that kind of stuff. Yep. That wears on you when you're going to that every single day. You're not going to always have those shifts where you may feel you make a difference. You could go 2, 3, 4. You could, some places, you could go a month without a call and where you think that you actually made a difference.
Right.
And if that's what you expect every day, you're going to get burnt out and you're not going to have any compassion. But if you can go to work every day and go, I'm going to train so that I know Brennan's coming home. I know anybody on my crew is coming home, because if we do our best job, anybody involved in that situation, they're going to go home. You're right. Still doing that same thing. But yeah, absolutely. Just your focus, that shift to focus, I think is the best description of how you have to do it. You got to be focused on your family, your crew.
And that's it. And at the same time, you know in your heart that you left it all on the field when you did go there, because you did everything you possibly could.
Yep.
You know, I was always taught this early on, you know, you go to a cold. Well, you're not going to save everybody. Mm-hmm. And I can still remember my first cold. And it was because, you know, as a young fireman, you're like, wow, we really sucked at that. We failed. You know, honestly, on that particular day, that guy had the best hands on him that he possibly could, right? And that was us. And we did our best, everything to our best of our ability, to our knowledge, to our level of training, and it just didn't work out.
Yep.
And what in this business, sometimes that's what happens.
Absolutely.
So you have to be able to accept that. And at the same time, keep the motivation to be the best that you possibly can. So that when that fire comes in, when that EMS comes in, when that auto extrication comes in, that these people do have the best people possible right then and there to get them out safely and have a better outcome. You just can't say enough.
Yeah. Well tied in and absolutely perfectly explained. So leads us right into now your chance. So what question do you have? Our next guest is going to be Captain Kenny. He's from Boston. And we got a question for you, so a question you have for him. So what would you like us to ask him? And you can make it as hard as Jeremy made it on you, or you can go easy on him. It's all in your court now. So,
you know, it's kind of ironic because Boston and Milwaukee are basically like, I mean, I don't know their company levels now, but, you know, for a long time, Boston was the same size as Milwaukee. I mean, yeah. You look at the stats, our run volumes are pretty much the same, you know, other than them cutting the shit out of us over the last few years, we were always the same. So honestly, I don't have a question off the top of my mind to ask him, other than we're out of car keys. But honestly, it's kind of difficult to come up with a question off the top of my head, because I know he's kind of experienced the same things, I have. In fact, I met some guys from Boston 2 years ago, and we went out to D.C. for the Rolling Thunder, and we hung out with those guys all week, had a great time. And I know Boston is just aggressive. Is very aggressive, as well as all the other departments. Honestly, I really don't have a question for him.
Huh?
Is that weird?
No, not at all. And you know, I think we know where to find you if you come up with one. So that's absolutely fine. We'll figure one out.
I'll give you a question through the month here. I'll think about it. We'll send you down the rabbit hole. Let Jeremy try to get me down.
Yeah,
yeah.
make it tough for him. Yeah, no, that'll be great. We'll have him on next month, so we have plenty of time that we'll be able to ask him that the one that you got for him.
Right.
So that concludes all the questions that we have now. So, I mean, this is the part I was kind of most excited for now is just, like we said, we call it the kitchen table because that's where this podcast idea started. That's where all those great ideas, solutions, gripes, everything come out is the kitchen table. So, I mean, what either story have you been reminded of as we're going through these questions you wanted to touch more on and talk about? Do you have anything for us that you want to add in or just kind of this is, you know, as well as everybody, what happens at the kitchen table. So this is fair, yeah. Fair game.
So, you know, I sent you that one picture, and that picture, you know, I can't get rid of it, man. It just, as soon as it gets cold in these parts here, and let me just give you a little background first of all, that picture, that picture came, and honestly, it actually wasn't even very cold out that day. I mean, and what I mean by very cold out, it was probably zero.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't 20, 30 below like some of the other fires. I'm sure there's a lot more cooler pictures out there. I learned from an old boss, Lenny Cryle, and he would do it at every fire, and I'm not shitting you guys. You'll laugh at this. So you got the fire burning on this side of the house or on this side of the street, right? And so what Lenny would do, he would come up to us, he'd get us together as a company, and he'd go, watch this. And he would point to the house across the street. And he would just point like that, right? And without fail, that was always in the newspaper. And Lenny got his picture in the paper more than anybody I knew. Just pointing somewhere other than where the fire was. And it was always an inside joke to us. And he's like, yeah, you know, those photographers, when you see a point, they want to grab that picture. You know? And so Lenny would always do that. All right. And so that particular picture that meme is made out of, that fire, it was probably, like I said, it was probably zero out. We had two and a halfs going, you know, the original building and it extended to an exposure, did a shit ton of overhaul. Obviously I don't like to get wet, but I got wet that day. And I had icicles. So they had a whole block, cordoned off. So the reporters couldn't go in there. So literally we got relieved on scene and we were going back to a battalion buggy that we were going to get back to quarters so we could change and get off shift. And the reporter just happened to take a picture of me and it ended up on paper. All right. So then flash forward about, I don't know, I would say a good 4 or 5 years. That picture along with those words came out. All right. And it stuck. And those words, you know, it's cold outside when you go outside and it's cold. I had mentioned that at a presentation one time, and the context that I was using it was much like we're talking about today. When you go to a training, realize that it is a way, all right? And just because somebody told you to do something a certain way doesn't mean it's got to be done that way, all right? And again, depending on your staffing levels, your skill levels, all of those things play into how you operate at a fire, all right? And the premise of that statement was, fellas, if you look at the thermostat and it says 32. Well, to us, 32, to somebody in Florida, 32 is, you know, 50 below.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To us, 32, we're still in our damn shorts. Right.
Yep.
To people in Canada, holy shit, you know, they're normal 40 below zero. That's normal, right. So my point was, don't just listen to one person and take that for gospel. You'll know it's cold outside when you go outside and it's cold, right? And that's how And then obviously they bastardized that thing. And now that picture makes its way around every flipping winter.
Gotta buy ice cream after you get your photo in the paper.
Did you ever think you'd be a meme? Did you ever think in all your years?
You know what's more comical about? Was if you Google, one of the guys did this just 2 weeks ago, if he Googled, I can't remember what he Googled. It was like, who called outside firemen or something like that? And that meme pops up.
Famous.
I'm like, you got to be shitting me. Right? but you know, it's all in good humor. You know what? If you can't laugh at yourself, you can't laugh at anybody else.
Yeah.
But like I said, fellas, I had a great career. I mean, I miss it dearly, but you know, hopefully I'm able to pass on a little education to you guys out here.
Absolutely.
You know, I love being involved. I love training. You know, I just fortunate, you know. Knock on wood. Like I said, if I would have known I was going to live this long, I'd have took a little better care of myself. But
you know, I thought you were bodybuilding now.
I read a couple books.
Yeah.
What? Nutrition down.
So, well, fellas, I can't thank you enough for asking me to be on here. I don't feel I'm worthy, but you know, hopefully you guys saw a little deeper into my soul here.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Sure.
Always learn something when talking.
Blast talking to you.
Yeah.
And you didn't even have to say banana.
I didn't. No.
Yeah. Nope. We didn't have to use banana. That'll be a story for next time, right?
Right.
Yeah. But no, we can't thank you enough. We're honored to have you on there, much like all of our guests. And we forgot to do this at the start, but along with thanking you, we're going to thank, you know, Jobtown, Taylor Tins, Crew First Ulster, Jeremy Sanders with them. Like, just everybody that's helped out and made this be possible to have you on here, to have all our future guests and everything here. It's just, it's insane. Blows us away every time we think about it, we talk to all these people. So just icing on the cake that we can, you know, show up tomorrow and still end up running a call with you and get to hear that from you. But you being able to give this information, all this knowledge to everybody else that's been listening, is just, we're honored that you're able to take some time and join us here. So,
well, thank you.
Yeah. Last thing we got, we started this last week with Jeremy. This episode's coming out. Actually, it'll be tonight, but you know, our shift saying, and you know what Brennan and I love to talk about with our shit bags. And that's what we've coined as the slogan for this podcast and how we're ending every single podcast. So, I'm going to end it with our don't be a shitbag. We got Brennan, and then we want our guests to end every week with it or every month with it as well. So you'll take us off with that final saying. So thank you for coming on. Pleasure to have you on. And guys, as always, don't be a shitbag.
Don't be a shitbag.
Get out there and train. Don't be a shitbag.
Oh, yeah.